From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Saudi Arabia and some of its allied Gulf states launched airstrikes into Yemen against rebel Shiite Houthi forces who've been gaining ground against what remains of the government. The coalition also includes the U.S. The Saudis say they're trying to help the embattled president, Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi. RT's Matt Trezza has more.
The Arab League has declared its full support for a Saudi-led air campaign launched to crush Houthi Shia militants who control vast areas of Yemen. Overnight strikes reportedly killed 65 people, including several rebel leaders. Thousands of Shia rebel supporters have taken to the streets from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, to protest against these airstrikes. The attacks, part of an operation dubbed Decisive Storm. Since the strike started Wednesday night, up to 65 people have been killed, according to initial reports.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia launched military operations in Yemen. The objective is to defend the legitimate government of President Hadi from the takeover attempts by the Houthi militias.
Saudi Arabia has deployed as many as 150,000 troops and 100 fighter jets, other Gulf state nations joining the operation. Among them, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, and Jordan. Egypt has reportedly sent 4 warships to the Gulf of Aden and now says it's ready to send ground troops if necessary, as has Sudan. Pakistan is considering whether to join the operation. Turkey has also announced its support. For some perspective, I'm joined by journalist Mohammed Al-Attab from Sana'a. Thank you for being here with us. So what's your take on the situation on the ground in Yemen?
Yes, regarding what's taking place in Yemen, it's really a growing and escalating developments with the rapid changes on the ground as the Houthis, who are supported by the military units loyal to the deposed ruler Ali Abdullah Saleh, along with the also after they have already captured the Aden city, we had this these kinds of regional interactions, reactions over what has taken place after the President Hadi has fled for the second time to unknown destination. So the situation in Yemen, there are many analytical reports about what's going on in Yemen. As the Houthis, when they have first made this kind of overrunning the capital Sana'a, there was no regional reactions over what has taken place. As there were also attempts to have this Yemen to have Yemen divided into different areas. It's called this kind of Sykes-Picot number 2. Sykes-Picot number 1 has divided the Arab lands into different states, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Iraq, and different countries. Now now there are new agendas to divide the Arab lands into different territories. But this time it will be divided. There are attempts to divide the Arab lands into sectarian regions. But what has taken place during the last 2 days, that the Houthis, supported by these army units, tried to prevent such kind of divisions. That's why these quick and strong reactions have taken place by the Saudi Arabia, which considers that this kind of move is in order to return back, to reinstate the legitimate president of the country and also to support his position, as an also an attempt to divide Yemen in the same between south and north.
The Arab League is discussing the military action in Yemen. What do you think they will decide?
Yes, the latest move, which has been taken by Saudi Arabia and also the other Gulf GCC states, when they have waged this kind of air raids in order to target military positions, and they have targeted the airports, and also they have damaged many casualties they have been inflicted on the Houthis and their military weaponry, and also they have targeted different air bases throughout the country. So this kind of growing war against the Houthis in order to return back the situation and to also to have this kind of the return back of the balance, military balance between the south and the north, and to have this kind of negotiations between the political rivals in order to submit to the GCC initiative, which has resolved the political, the 2011 political crisis, and also divided Yemen in order to have this kind of the continuation of the peaceful transition. But so far, many Yemenis are expecting the situation would further escalate, especially that the Saudi Arabia, for the first time, has waged this kind of air raid supported by the GCC states and Egypt and different Arab countries. Now we are moving to a new scale, which is the regional war between Arab nations, which is many political analysts warn that this kind of developments will have kind of this impact of the between the Arab people. This kind of war, which only would lead to more catastrophic events, and also this bad developments for the Arab nations, and incite it sectarian wars among themselves. It's not encouraging development, and so far the Yemeni people, also the Houthis have considered this kind of development as a violation to the country's sovereignty. After that, they have already controlled most of the territories.
Thank you very much for your time and your insight. Mohammed Al-Attab, journalist, joining us from Sana'a. U.S. president has authorized logistical and intelligence support for Saudi Arabia as it launches airstrikes on Yemeni rebels. In Yemen, the U.S. is believed to have lost track of about $500 million worth of arms and equipment since 2007. Officials acknowledge they're unable to account for more than a million rounds of ammunition, 160 Humvees, 200 M4 rifles, 250 body armor suits, among other items. We talked with a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel for her perspective.
What the U.S. government is focused on is putting arms out there and creating buyers for those arms. The U.S. taxpayer subsidizes foreign weapon sales. So we're always out there. Our government is always out there looking for places to market our weapons. When you look at what we do in foreign policy as a way of creating a weapon from a market for our weapons, we're actually not doing that bad. That's where we spend our money, that's where our intellectual power goes, not in solving crises which are between ethnic groups or religious groups, not in promoting good governance. That's not our expertise, and we don't spend time and money on that. We spend time and money in creating consumers for our weapons.
Not all of Yemen's neighbors have joined in the Saudi-led invasion. Iran called it reckless and said it would only further the spread of terrorism in the region. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Iran says the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen is serving the interests of Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and Takfiri groups. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also warned regional and Western countries not to be part of such unthoughtful games. Zarif said Iran has been calling for talks between the opposing sides in Yemen since the beginning of the conflict. He said this is the only way to resolve issues in the country. Zarif made those comments on the sidelines of nuclear talks in the Swiss city of Lausanne. Earlier, Iran's foreign ministry spokeswoman Marzia Afkham condemned the Saudi-led attacks on Yemen, saying such assaults would expand terrorism and insecurity in the region. Meanwhile, Russia has expressed its deep concern over the situation in Yemen, but said it has no plans to evacuate its citizens from the Arab country. To discuss that further, I joined Mr. Ridwan Risk, who is a political commentator, and he is joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Risk, I wanted to get your initial reactions to this invasion.
Well, I believe this is something that a very foolish step coming from the regional coalition and the Pakistanis as well, because I believe that this is something that is going to drag the whole region into a major war, because what was happening in Yemen was something very, you know, internal problems. It was going to, you know, local conflicts inside Yemen between both sides. But now the situation evolved in a different way, which is, you know, became now an international issue, and it's not a just regional or local anymore. And this is might just ignite a major war between countries, because as we know, that's the important importance of the situation or the position of Yemen, and that the Iranian cannot just sit there watching what was going on, and the interference of those you know, the GCCs in Yemen that could just turn the situation upside down in a way that will ignite a civil war, and this is going to take a very long time to be solved, while it was going to be solved as you know, sooner than they were expecting, because you know, they just the disappearance of the president, and they just the escape to Aden, and some news saying that he is not in Aden, even he's in Saudi Arabia. He escaped to Saudi Arabia, and things were going to be solved and to be, you know, to reform a new government in Yemen. Now things are not going to be solved the way that it was going to. And the most important issue, the other important issue, is that now we are going to see another divided Yemen, because, you know, they just keeping the Aden itself outside the authorities of Yemen, or the new government in Yemen under the authority of the capital Sana'a, is going just to draw the lines between both north and south Yemen permanently, and that will lead to create another two Yemen. And this is a very catastrophic situation created by the Saudis. The question remains that where were they, those countries who now are joining or just formed this new this coalition to attack the Yemeni people or the Yemeni cities? Where were they when the Israelis were attacking Gaza, killing thousands of Palestinians? They were watching, and just the position that was for them was just condemning, and nothing but condemning, and that was something that to be ashamed of. Now I believe that the Saudis are just implementing or taking the position of the Israelis, and now the Israelis are could be very comfortable with what was going on in the Arab world, and this is going to just to solve the Palestinian problem in a way that we will never see a Palestinian state created, because dividing of Yemen, and they are working on dividing of Iraq, dividing on Syria, and this is something that it's going to be a disaster to the Arab world. And on top of that the Egyptians should be more rational, because people are betting on that. Everybody betted on that President Sisi could be more rational and more aware that the involvement of Egypt in a war in Yemen, especially to the previous experience to the Egyptian people, is not going. It's not something to be proud of or successful, because the Egyptians might pay another price as they did before, and that was a big mistake, and they admitted themselves. So the whole situation now, and we have to mention that this situation in Yemen is also connected to the table of negotiations in Geneva or Lausanne. This is something that's considering the program, the nuclear program of the peaceful nuclear program of Iran, and this is something to pressure Iran, because they know that the new government of Yemen is a very strong is going to be, or it is, a strong ally to Iran, and does not agree, or it's an opposition to the Saudis and the policies of the Saudis and the Gulf regions. So due to this resistance against the brutality or just the invasion of America to the region, so they are trying to destroy any kind of resistance, and the Saudis now are just implementing the strategy of United mm-hmm. States and its allies, Israel.
That was Mr. Ridwan Risk, who is a political commentator who had been speaking to us from the Lebanese capital.
The action is being taken without the approval of the UN Security Council. Middle East current affairs analyst Sami Ramadani spoke about this with RT on Thursday.
There is no legal ground at all, because the Security Council hasn't sanctioned it. The United Nations hasn't even put Yemen under Chapter 7 so that it could be used as a pretext to attack Yemen. I think under international law, this will be regarded as a naked aggression. And the United States is playing the role of of as though they are not actively involved. I think this is not the case. I think, like in Libya, the United States is taking a back seat while really being extremely active and proactive in this campaign led by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi royal family. So the close alliance between the United States and the Saudi royal family is so strong that it is extremely unlikely that the Saudis would venture to do such a large-scale military attack against a sovereign state like Yemen without U.S. blessing, participation, and support. And let's also not forget that the United States itself has been carrying out bombing raids in Yemen, although they have reduced it recently because they regard the advance of the so-called Houthis and their allies. The Houthis are not just a small minority. They are more than a third of the population of Yemen, and they have built close alliances with other forces, secular, left, among Sunnis and so on. There is a history of tolerance in Yemen. Yemen hasn't known any sectarian strife of the nature that's being proposed today by the Saudis and others, as if it's they are fighting Iran or something. They are really going to fight the Yemeni people.
Rahmani also pointed out that the U.S. again finds itself on the same side of a conflict with Al-Qaeda.
The Al-Qaeda organization, which is called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, has been fighting against the Houthis and their allies. And also ISIS as well has been conducting suicide attacks against them. So we have now a de facto alliance between the Saudi royal family, Qatari royal family, Turkey, United States, in alliance with these Al-Qaeda forces and the ISIS who have recently emerged in Yemen as well. So it's quite murky waters, and to portray it as some sort of a sectarian strife, I think, is grossly exaggerated. It was foreseen because it's not the first time that Saudi Arabia doesn't intervene in Yemen, and they have been threatening and making noises about greater intervention in recent weeks. Historically, they have backed former royalist families, opposed Yemen's independence from British colonial rule. So Saudis have always had a finger in the internal affairs of Yemen. And it didn't really come as a surprise to me, because the Saudi royal family has always considered Yemen as an irritant because of a very strong independence movement, nationalist movement, secular left movements. So it's been a major headache for the Saudi royal family. And in the past 10 years or so, the Qatari royal family started also playing a big role in Yemen in terms of backing various armed groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood there. And the Saudis, on the other hand, backed other groups closer to the state machinery of Yemen, especially under President Saleh, who was overthrown after the uprising in 2011.
Observers feared that the Yemeni conflict could escalate to a military standoff based on sectarian religious grounds between the regional Sunni monarchies on one side and the Shiite regimes of the region supported by Iran on the other. A call at the UN for the government of Israel to commit to the so-called two-state solution. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Robert Seri, urged the incoming Israeli government to quickly demonstrate its commitment to that process. Seri was briefing the Security Council at UN headquarters in New York Thursday on ways to end what he called, quote, the longest ongoing occupation in modern history, closed quote. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
In his statement to the Council, UN Special Envoy Robert Seri underlined some of his most pressing concerns.
We congratulate Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Likud party on winning the highest number of seats, and note that President Rivlin has invited him to form the next government, a process that may take several weeks. However, I am frankly concerned by many of the hardline statements put forward in the final days of campaigning, in particular remarks by the Prime Minister raising serious doubts about Israel's commitment to the two-state solution. I urge the incoming Israeli government to seize the opportunity of a fresh mandate to quickly demonstrate in words, and more importantly by actions, this commitment.
The UN Special Coordinator added that it remains the primary responsibility of the Security Council to play its role in developing a new peace architecture for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Speaking to the press after the briefing, the Palestinian ambassador, Riyad Mansour, said Mr. Seri had made a very strong appeal to the Security Council on its responsibility towards the peace process.
There is a collective responsibility placed upon all of us, especially the Security Council, to defend the two-state solution. We totally agree with him in that assessment, and we hope that the Security Council would rise up to that level and take that responsibility very seriously.
In response to the Palestinian ambassador, Israeli Ambassador Ron Prosor shared a different vision on the kind of negotiations his country says are needed.
Well, I'd just like to call into memory for all of us that through direct negotiations, we made peace with Egypt. Through direct negotiations, we made peace with Jordan. Only through direct negotiations, which are frustrating, not easy, but, you know, that's the only way to achieve lasting peace. Trying to circumvent things and run away from direct negotiations would not lead to peace, but to additional violence and frustrations.
Meanwhile, the Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Robert Seri, was briefing the Security Council for the last time. He will be replaced in April by Nikolai Mladenov, who has formerly served as the top UN official in Iraq. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons. We act to protect thousands of innocent people in Kosovo from a mounting military offensive. We act to prevent a wider war, to defuse a powder keg at the heart of Europe. By acting now, we are upholding our values, protecting our interests, and advancing the cause of peace. Tonight I want to speak with you about the tragedy in Kosovo and why it matters to America that we work with our allies to end it. Let me explain what it is we are responding to. Kosovo is a province of Serbia in the middle of southeastern Europe. Its people are mostly ethnic Albanian and mostly Muslim. In 1989, Serbia's leader, Slobodan Milosevic, stripped Kosovo of the constitutional autonomy its people enjoyed, thus denying them their right to speak their language, run their schools, shape their daily lives. For years, Kosovars struggled peacefully to get their rights back. When President Milosevic sent his troops and police to crush them, the struggle grew violent.
That was then U.S. President Bill Clinton on March 24, 1999, 16 years ago this past Tuesday, as he announced the beginning of what was characterized as a humanitarian bombing campaign against Yugoslavia over the breakaway province of Kosovo. The U.S.-led NATO bombing campaign killed hundreds of civilians and destroyed apartment buildings, farms, schools, hospitals, and churches, even hitting the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, killing three Chinese journalists and injuring another 20 Chinese nationals. Between March 24th and June 10th of 1999, NATO aircraft flew over 38,000 combat missions against Yugoslavia, mostly concentrated on the capital Belgrade and Kosovo, the flashpoint of the conflict. Using fighter jets as well as long-range cruise missiles from warships in the Adriatic Sea, NATO destroyed vital strategic infrastructure, including bridges, government buildings and factories, and critical civilian infrastructure, including power plants and water processing facilities, causing substantial environmental and economic damage to the country. The NATO campaign also resulted in the deaths of at least hundreds of civilians, with Serbian sources reporting more than 2,000 civilians and 1,000 service personnel killed, more than 5,000 wounded, and over 1,000 missing. On Tuesday, a pair of non-governmental organizations in Serbia said NATO should pay compensation for the massive damage inflicted by the bombing. According to a report in the Russian news agency TASS, retired General Jovo Milanovic said that NATO's military offensive, which was not sanctioned by the United Nations, represented, quote, a violation of all norms of international law that caused enormous material damage to Yugoslavia and huge human casualties, closed quote. Serbian experts put the price tag of the devastation between $60 and $100 billion. The war on Yugoslavia represented the first test application of the U.S.'s integrated regime change strategy, which apparently still holds sway in Washington, fielding a combination of tactics that would be further developed and perfected in later conflicts in such places as Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Ukraine. For a closer look at the U.S. intervention in Yugoslavia and how it relates to those subsequent conflicts, we spoke with Nebojša Mališ, a foreign affairs expert, web writer at RT America, and blogger on Serbian affairs via telephone from Washington, D.C., Thursday. People here in the United States are fairly ignorant of what happened there. You want to give us a little background?
Well, it's really the first postmodern war. Though the involvement in Bosnia was a peacekeeping operation under UN auspices in 1995, the 1999 war was just an outright war of aggression in which NATO basically said that accused the Serbian government of violating the human rights of the Albanians in Kosovo following a armed rebellion of a group that was perpetrating terrorist attacks against the police and civilians, and launched a 78-day bombing campaign with the intention of forcing Serbia to give independence to Kosovo and turn it over to this rebel movement. The intervention didn't succeed in that. Serbia successfully defended itself long enough to negotiate a peace deal in which the NATO-led peacekeeper mission would provide for an interim government. And unfortunately, NATO didn't really live up to its part of the bargain, because they ended up creating an independent state of Kosovo in 2008. Which Serbia has so far refused to recognize. And to counter any sort of Serbian resistance, they ended up appointing a new government in Belgrade in 2000 and appointing a string of new governments since, each more subservient to Washington than the next, in order to finally break any sort of resistance and legitimize the war. As, you know, at the time it was said it was illegal but legitimate, which was the conclusion of a commission that was appointed by NATO to whitewash the whole thing. And they've since been trying to make it both legal and legitimate through whatever means possible. But during the war, there were all these wild, crazy claims of Serbian atrocities and genocide and everything else, and none of them have been substantiated despite extensive research on the ground. They never came up with the reported mass graves or anything like that. It certainly does sound familiar. That's exactly what the current government in Ukraine installed in the February 2014 coup has been doing in the two regions in the east of the country, and attempted to do in Crimea before the referendum stopped them. The reported Serb repression was really a case of not false flag, but flipping the script, rather, because it was the Serbian state, the Yugoslavian state, that ended up building a university and essentially infrastructure and all the trappings of civilization for the ethnic Albanian population in Kosovo since 1945, and basically ended up giving them a province on the silver platter in terms of their participation in the government, language rights, just about every, in fact, privilege, because for a while there, Kosovo actually had veto power over Serbian legislation, whereas Serbia didn't have the same right in its own province. And the Albanians rejected all of that as not enough and demanded outright statehood, at least this particular movement did. And when Serbia decided, well, okay, this is too much, we're going to have to restore our constitutional order, and successfully did so peacefully in 1989, there were some rumors of a rebellion, but nothing really came of it. It wasn't until 1998, when the armed groups actually received support from the United States and NATO, that an armed rebellion really began. And so you have a situation in which the U.S. backed an armed rebellion in a country it didn't like, but condemns self-defense in a against a government that it does like, that it put into power. For all the U.S. officials' invocation of international law over the past year aimed at Russia, it just rings supremely hypocritical and hollow, considering that international law seems to apply only selectively, If a government is an ally or a proxy of the U.S., it can do anything. And if a government is not a proxy of the U.S. or opposed, then it's not allowed to do anything at all.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.